is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The fact that we are able to gather physically for this meeting is a testament to our common resolve and determination to bring an end to this enemy that has ravaged every aspect of our lives and reversed some of the progress we have made as humankind.
That was Monique Nsanzabaganwa, Vice Chairperson of the African Union, addressing the African Union European Union Ministerial Meeting in Rwanda. Details coming up. Also, the international community is calling for the return of civilian administration in Sudan. And the ECOWAS Special Representative in Mali has been given 72 hours to leave the country. These stories and more ahead on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. Roads to the Sudanese capital are blocked by protesters who are demanding a return to civilian rule after yesterday's military takeover. Criticism of the takeover has been pouring out from around the world, including from the United States. Washington has frozen $700 million in emergency economic support funds for Sudan. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres this morning strongly condemned the military takeover and called for the release of the Prime Minister and other officials who have been arrested. The UN Security Council meets later today behind closed doors to consider how to deal with the developments, which include security forces opening fire on demonstrators, a shutdown of most telecommunications, and the arrests of Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok and other officials. Military leader General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan told reporters that Hamdok is safe at the military headquarters in Khartoum and will be released if his security is guaranteed. VOA's Joe Tanza spoke with South Sudan in Focus reporter Michael Atit in Khartoum, who has been monitoring the situation since the military takeover. Atit reports that Burhan said the political divisions in the country meant the process of establishing courts and other systems had not succeeded and put the country at risk.
He tried to say these political forces were actually divided into the extent that some of them were instigating violence and some of them were even instigating tribes against tribes. So it was almost coming to a sort kind of creating a civil war again, according to him. So he said this is a sole responsibility of the Sudanese army by law, that to make sure the security and the safety of the Sudan, to defend the people of Sudan in any threat.
Governments across the world, including in Africa, are calling for the reinstatement of the civilian administration in Sudan following the military takeover in Khartoum yesterday. The African Union says the army must immediately release Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok and other members of his government so that dialogue can resume to save the country and its democratic transition. Darren Taylor has more.
Sudanese lawyer and peace activist Amir Suleiman says large crowds remain on the streets to protest against the military takeover. According to medical groups, soldiers have killed at least 7 people and wounded scores. Suleiman says the brutality of the military faction doesn't shock him, because some are former members of the Janjaweed militia. The International Criminal Court says the Janjaweed, acting on the orders of deposed former Sudanese dictator Omar al-Bashir, massacred thousands of people in Sudan's Darfur region in the 2000s. Suleiman says the Janjaweed have since transformed into the army's rapid force unit, which is currently deployed against citizens demonstrating against the military action.
So many people, they were being injured, shot by this rapid force personnel, and many of them, they have wounds and whatever.
Suleiman, like many Sudanese, isn't surprised by the takeover. The lawyer says the signs were there when some rebel groups and part of Hamdok's administration recently called for exactly this. Suleiman says he's also not shocked by what he calls confusing statements made by the general who led the military action, Abdel al-Burhan.
He mentioned that he's supporting the constitutional document and Juba peace agreement, but at the same time, he declared the state of emergency and also he dismissed the Sovereign Council and the cabinet as well.
The Sovereign Council was established to lead Sudan toward democracy after a popular uprising led to al-Bashir's overthrow 2 years ago. Now, says Suleiman, after a period of promise, the Sudanese people face very tough times ahead.
People are calling for a strike in everywhere. The doctors now in a strike, the bankers in a strike, and the others they are going to follow. So I think the state will be in a critical situation.
The Sudanese Professionals Association says it supports a national strike. It's also calling for street resistance to what it calls Burhan's reckless decisions. Professor Ibo Mandaza of the Wits University School of Governance says it's back to square one for Sudan.
Everything is really in reverse now. The economic and political crisis persists. It's very sad indeed.
He says economic hardship, which worsened in recent months, set the scene for the military takeover.
The government of Abdalla Hamdok had to engage the international financial institutions towards some kind of package to assist in the economic recovery. Typically and characteristically, such packages come with enormous difficulties for the population, austerity measures in particular. And these are the ones that have provoked this series of demonstrations in the last few weeks. I think Hamdok and his administration did not assess too closely the possible implications of effecting the IMF packages.
But Suleiman says many Sudanese would rather endure financial suffering for now than return to the days of authoritarianism. He says his compatriots want democracy and everything that goes with it.
To end up this coup, we have our civilian government back and respecting our constitutional document. We have a constitutional court because it is frozen since this revolution. Also, we have a chief justice.
Burhan has pledged to hold elections in July 2023, after which he says he'll cede power to a democratically elected government. Suleiman says many Sudanese don't trust the promise. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
A bomb exploded on a long-distance bus in Uganda yesterday evening, injuring several people. It follows a bombing at a cafe last Saturday that killed one person and injured three others. Yesterday's incident was confirmed as a suicide bomb attack by police spokesperson Fred Enanga, the French news agency AFP reported. He added that the bomber was on a wanted list of members of the Allied Democratic Forces, ADF. Historically, a Ugandan rebel group, the ADF, has been accused of killing thousands of civilians in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. In March, the United States officially linked the ADF to the Islamic State group. The African Union European Union ministerial meeting is underway after a delay due to COVID-19, with focus on forging partnerships to help Africa pull through the challenges of the coronavirus and build back better. Eugene Uwimana has more details from Rwanda's capital, Kigali, where the meeting is being held.
The impact of COVID-19 and ways to revamp strategies for sustainable economic transformation are the top priorities of envoys of African Union and European Union countries. Dr. Monique Nsanzabaganwa, the vice chairperson of African Union, told the meeting she's optimistic about shaping action because all counterparts are present.
The fact that we are able to gather physically for this meeting is a testament to our common resolve and determination to bring an end to this enemy that has ravaged every aspect of our lives and reversed some of the progress we have made as humankind. Since the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic, the world as we know it has changed rapidly, with far-reaching consequences we are still trying to ascertain.
60 foreign affairs ministers are among 500 participants at the second African Union-European Union ministerial meeting. Generally, the agenda is to chart a way forward to building development and resilience. Rita Lajarinha is the managing director of the European External Action Services.
The draft joint communique addresses our common priorities, ranging from the COVID-19 response and recovery, investment in the digital and green transitions, as well as global peace, security and governance, and migration and mobility.
The permanent secretary of the Rwandan Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Clementine Mukeka, reiterated the importance of bolstering the AU-EU partnership.
I think this meeting is an occasion to renew our commitment to strengthen existing cooperation, as well as to explore new areas of cooperation. And it also gives us an opportunity to reflect on the AU-EU relationship to date, to recognize what has worked and also what has not worked in the past, and also suggest areas of improvement.
The first AU-EU ministerial meeting took place in 2019 in Brussels. Eugene Uimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
The Libyan Stabilization Conference that concluded in Tripoli on Friday reiterated the need for elections to be held as scheduled on December 24th. The 30 international delegates also stressed the importance of taking the necessary measures to build confidence and create an appropriate environment for holding vote in a fair, transparent and inclusive manner. Wolfgang Paschtei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
The Libya Stabilization Conference was an initiative by the Libyan Foreign Minister Naila Al-Mangoush, who has not really an influential position within the government. Actually, during the conference, there was nothing really new. There was not even a common final statement because the delegations were not able to agree on some key points, especially the demand for the withdrawal of all the foreign mercenaries and forces, including Turkey, remained quite controversial. One thing was really remarkable. Turkey, the key ally of the current government, was represented only by a deputy minister of foreign affairs.
The conference stated that ending the conflict and achieving security and stability in Libya is a basis for peace and state building, a pillar for peaceful coexistence, and a motive for the acceleration of the economy and development. What's needed practically to achieve such a target?
First and foremost, an executive, a government, and a legislative, a parliament, legitimated by credible elections is required. Then on the security side, a reliable supervision of the ceasefire is necessary. I doubt personally that 60 civilian UN observers will be enough to achieve this. Stability is also required in the greater capital area, in the greater Tripoli area, where there is fighting between the various militias, who are all considered part of the security forces, at least every other week. On the political side, as it can be seen just right now, about the quarrels between the Cyrenaica and Tripolitania, the ongoing quarrels, regionalization and an agreement about the distribution of the oil revenues between the central state and the three historic provinces is mandatory. Libya must be stabilized through regionalization. There are way too deep rifts between the provinces and in some areas, especially in Tripolitania and Fezzan, even between cities and tribes. On the economic side, security and political stability should certainly help to stabilize the oil and gas production. There should not be any additional or any future blockades of the oil terminals. But Libya also needs foreign know-how, foreign investors and foreign companies who are right now still hesitant to return to Libya. Libya would also need to honor obligations from the past and find settlements with the many companies who have lost a huge amount of money immediately after the revolution. This should help to build trust with them and convince them to return. Libya should work not only on Turkish companies with regard to compensations, as Turkish support won't be enough for Libya's economy to recover.
The U.S. Ambassador and Special Envoy to Libya, Richard Norland, expressed his belief that holding the Libyan elections on scheduled time remained possible, but he urged all Libyan parties to do what's required to reach the greatest degree of consensus to hold elections on its time. What's missing here?
I would say there is already a drive towards the elections. Chairman of the High National Election Commission, Emad Al-Zayeh, announced last Sunday the roadmap towards the elections. Candidate registration is scheduled to begin simultaneously for both elections in the first half of November for the parliamentary and the presidential elections. Candidates were already encouraged to collect the required number of declarations of support from registered voters. The first round of presidential elections should be held on 24 December, and the second round, together with the parliamentary elections, should be held 1 month later. Al-Zayeh said that the elections will be held according to the electoral laws from the House of Representatives. He said correctly that the HOR is not a political party, but the legislator. He added that the HNEC is obliged to implement the laws coming from the HOR. Whoever may be against them should take legal actions. From my point, two things are clear right now. If one wants to have elections on 24 December, it is necessary to go with the HOR laws, even if they may not be perfect. If one wants to prevent elections anytime soon, he should demand the laws to be renegotiated. I would say Libyans should show their support for one or the other candidate at the ballot box, which is much more efficient than staying away from the elections. The international community should urge now the High Council of State and other groups so that they give up their resistance against the electoral laws. The IC should urge candidates and other political and military stakeholders to accept the outcome of the elections, like the former Minister of Interior and presidential candidate Fatih Bashagha from Misrata already did. Candidates should be urged to register. Libya needs a man of integrity as president, rooted in Libyan tradition, but with good connections to international actors and who stayed preferably out of day-by-day politics in Libya during the last years.
That was Wolfgang Poshtai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi. A South African court today dismissed former President Jacob Zuma's effort to have the main prosecutor removed from his corruption case. The application, which was launched at the beginning of the trial, has delayed the start of proceedings in the Pietermaritzburg High Court. Zuma is facing charges that include fraud, racketeering, money laundering and corruption stemming from his role in arms purchasing by the government when South Africa got its independence in 1994. But as Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg, Zuma is likely to appeal the ruling, further delaying the trial's start.
In his special plea application to get lead prosecutor Billy Downer removed from the case, Zuma argued he is biased and vindictive, saying he leaked confidential medical information to a journalist. However, in his judgment, Judge Pete Cohen dismissed all 14 grounds that served as the basis for Zuma's application.
Many were based on speculation or suspicion, or are based on inadmissible hearsay evidence and not on fact, even if in limited instances they might at best qualify as possible irregularities. These irregularities were not such as to require Mr. Downer's removal as prosecutor.
The judge ordered that the trial must commence on the 11th of April, but experts say there's no guarantee. A few days ago, Zuma opened a police case against Downer for allegedly leaking his confidential medical health information to a journalist. Zuma could now approach the courts asking it to hold the case until a court of law decides on the pending police case. On the other hand, Zuma's lawyer, Thabani Masuku, hinted in a question directed to the judge that the former president was considering all options after studying today's judgment.
If there should be a interlocutory application that has nothing to do with the trial, but has to do with this matter, could be an application for leave to appeal, okay, or anything like that. Well, can he be excused from attending the trial?
However, the National Prosecuting Authority, NPA, says it is ready for any and all Zuma's tactics. NPA spokesperson Mthunzi Maka addressed the media outside the court.
Whatever legal avenue they explore, as the prosecution, we are ready. We have vigorously opposed this application based on solid arguments which found their way into the judgment. We are going to apply the same meticulous prosecution strategy that we applied in the appeal that they'll be mounting against the judgment of Judge Cohn.
Zuma was present in court even though he was recently granted parole after prison officials concluded he was too sick to finish his 15-month contempt of court sentence in prison. He has been seen in public addressing media and crowds of his supporters. Thuso Khumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
United Nations officials say more than 100,000 people are displaced in central Somalia following days of fighting between the government forces and a group opposing the regional's local administration. Aid workers say they are struggling to provide the displaced with basic necessities. Mohammed Yusuf has the report.
The clashes that began last week in Goreal town in Somalia's Galmudug Federal State are reported to have killed at least 120 people, most of them soldiers or fighters. The fighting is between government forces and their former ally, Islamist group Ahlus Sunnah wal Jamaah. Goreal is the second largest town in Galmudug State, and both sides want to control the town ahead of parliamentary elections. Speaking at a virtual conference Tuesday, James Swan, the UN representative in Somalia, called for an end to the fighting.
We are concerned that this is a distraction from other critical priorities, namely a completion of the electoral process and a continuation of the fight against al-Shabaab. As a consequence, we would certainly welcome efforts by the parties to this conflict to pause the ongoing hostilities and explore opportunities for talks or dialogue that might allow for a peaceful resolution of this situation without further suffering of the people.
Mohamed Ayoya, UNICEF's country representative in Somalia, says the aid agencies are struggling to provide humanitarian assistance to the population in the area.
Our assessment so far has shown that 20,000 households have been displaced, and that's about more than 100,000 people. And of course, the problem there is that getting access to these people with the services that we can offer at the time is extremely complicated and difficult. So as we speak, we are indeed on the ground with our partners trying to provide services in terms of water and sanitation, hygiene, but also food.
The aid agencies say health centers have been damaged in the conflict, reducing people's ability to access health care. The UN also said a local humanitarian organization was targeted while doing their work and one of its workers was killed. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said 7.7 million Somalis will be in need of assistance in 2022 as conflict, unpredictable weather patterns and diseases continue to disrupt people's lives. In recent months, Somalia has been locked in political crisis due to delays in elections caused by threats from al-Shabaab militants and disagreement over the process. Swan says the postponement contributes to the overall state of distress in the country.
These delayed elections are occupying such a central place in the attention of the leadership of the country at this time that unfortunately it is causing other critical priorities to be deferred. And we can really look across the board at the development agenda. We can look at additional work to be done in the security sector. We can look at longer term state building priorities around the constitution, around establishing rule of law institutions, judicial institutions.
In hopes of ending the Galmudug conflict, Somali opposition groups have urged the government to stop sending reinforcement troops to the town. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.